Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have a Perdita!
Swangles and we're locked in.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you're watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thanks a million. We appreciate your support. Hey, if you want to get out of the cold areas where you live in February, the first week, and want to go to Acapulco, Mexico, maybe go to check out an Acapulco 2023. It'll be a good time. I'll be one of the speakers there, obviously, with Berwick. You can check out Dr. Ron Paul will be there. He's been there a couple years. He's always, it's hard to get a standing ovation from a bunch of anarchists, but Dr. Ron Paul always seems to do it. Max Egan will be there, Larkin Rose, David Icke, Dan Dix, Del Bigtree, Mark Passio, Dr. Andrew Kaufman, Dr. Carrie Madej. If you have kids and you want to be a part of, they have a kids camp there too. If you're interested in crypto, there's plenty of crypto stages going on. Lots happening. If you're interested, the link will be in the description, anarchapulco.com, and you can use the promo code MACRO to save yourself some money while you're at it. Thanks to our newest sponsor, Legal Shield. I feel kind of dumb for not signing up for them earlier, but I appreciate their support. Tony Arterburn, our gold and silver sponsor, put me in contact with them. He's been a member of theirs for over 20 years and said I should check it out. I'm really glad that he made that suggestion, because not only did I check it out, I signed up for their service. And I think it's probably something we should all look into. This company started in 1972. They have an A-plus rating with a Better Business Bureau. They're available in the United States and Canada if you're interested. And basically what it is this. It's the collective buying power of all of us directed towards high-power law offices in your area. It's pretty simple. It works out to like a dollar a day. It's 30 bucks a month. You get access to lawyers in your area that can help you with a variety of things. If you have legal documents you need them to take a look at, if you've had a, I don't know, let's say you got a speeding ticket and you want to send it over to them and see if they can work on it. What about if you're just unsure about your rights? And my God, these days, who knows? Do we even have any rights anymore? It doesn't seem like it. You've got an attorney now. You can send questions over to them. You can send documents to them. If you don't have a last will and testament, or you don't have a financial power of attorney, or a medical power of attorney, these are things you've got to get. They're a pain in the butt. They cost a lot of money. So do this. If you're interested, sign up for the service and knock out all the legal documents that you have right away. Just one shot. Knock them all out. We set up a website. You can take a look over there. See what you think. Read up on it. If it's right for you, pull the trigger. If not, that's cool. No, you'll never get a hard sell from me. But if you want to go to this website, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com, and just read up for yourself. Get yourself protected. We chose that domain name because the idea of us getting pushed around by people that have attorneys, it's a real thing. we can level that playing field a little bit. So I think that we should take a look and see for ourselves. So if you are interested, all I ask, go to the website and read up about it. Don'tgetpushedaround.com is the website, and take a look. Also, our other sponsor, Solar Power Lifestyle. Thanks, guys, to them. They're a small business. They're a veteran-owned business. They like this show. We like that. They've got a vast selection of solar power generators out there. You can get ones for your house if you want. Now, I don't know that everybody's lining up for that, but if you're just looking for a smaller one, a portable one, maybe one for your job site or one for the car, or maybe keep it in your garage in case of emergencies, go to solarpowerlifestyle.com and just take a look, see what you think. You can use the promo code MACRO on your way out to save yourself some money. They have free shipping on all products. So just one of those things. Let's be a little bit proactive as opposed to being reactive. Solarpowerlifestyle.com, promo code MACRO. All of the links and all the promo codes and all that will be in the show notes, so we can, you don't have to, if you're driving around, you don't have to write it down. So, well, I'll tell you what, we are at a point now where everything feels very tense, very weird. And if I want to know what's going on in the global, on the global chessboard, as Brzezinski said, I have to reach out to the guys that actually know this stuff inside and out. So we've had Scott Horton on before. He's over there at Antiwar. It's our pleasure to have Kyle Anzalone. He is the assistant editor over at antiwar.com. Good to meet you, Kyle. How are you?
Very good. Nice to meet you as well.
Well, we've got problems, as you guys might have noticed, going on all over the world here. And it feels very, oh, I don't know. Well, let's start in Ukraine. It feels like a made-for-TV war to me. Very Wag the Dog. There's a lot of green screens happening. I don't recall that being a thing in wars of the past, but I could be wrong. I'm sure there was their version of the green screen was happening. What do you guys make of this war over in Ukraine? Because it's been going on now for the better part of this entire year. And it seems to kind of, I don't know, depending on what the mainstream media had for breakfast, it seems to be the most important thing in the world or a non-issue. What do you guys make of it all?
Yeah, well, I do think it's probably the most important thing going on in the world right now, not because of, you know, the territorial dispute in Eastern Europe, but rather the fact that this is pitting the United States and Russia in a very dread proxy war being fought right now in Ukraine. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars of American and NATO weapons being flooded onto the Ukrainian battlefield. Ukrainian troops are being trained all over Europe by American, British, German forces on how to use these more advanced weapon systems. And the goal is to kill and weaken Russia, as you know, Lloyd Austin, our Secretary of Defense, made very clear in the early days of the war. You know, this war is about weakening Russia. And we really saw that during the spring when there were negotiations happening, there were deals actually on the table that were fairly acceptable to Kiev and Moscow. Now, was every detail worked out? Maybe not, but, you know, Sergei Lavrov and others have been very explicit saying that there was an acceptable deal proposed by Kiev that Moscow was willing to pull the trigger on. And then UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson went to Kiev, and, you know, this has been reported by the French government, the UK government, Ukrainian Pravda, all reported that what Boris Johnson did when he went over there was he discouraged Ukraine from negotiating. And we heard this from the Turkish foreign minister, because Turkey was leading the diplomacy, that for some members of NATO, they want to weaken Russia and they want this war to go on. And at the time, you know, maybe it was just like the Lithuanians or something, this was marginal, but that turned out not to be the case. It was, you know, the Anglos, the UK, the Americans, who are intentionally dragging this war on and stretching it out, because they know that it's costing Russia billions of dollars, at least tens of thousands of their troops, you know, their tanks are being depleted and things like that on this Ukrainian battlefield. So, you know, from the early days of this war, what we were saying, that this is about fighting Russia to the last Ukrainian. And that seems to be how it's very much playing out so far.
Man, what a shitty thing to fight this war to the last Ukrainian, you know, and we do this all the time. It's so frustrating to watch how we work. We go around saying, you know, we're spreading democracy and freedom. And really what we're doing is we're financing wars. We have the opportunity to end this war early. I've been hearing this too, or springtime. So, I don't know. I don't know how many people have died from that point forward, but they all could be. Everything could have been prevented if we had stepped in. So the plan is just to fight a resource war against them, to drain them financially. I would imagine our sanctions didn't really work all that well. It seemed to have backfired. And when they pegged the ruble to gold, that seemed to be it seemed to be a play out of our own playbook. You know, back when we had the dollar backed by gold, it seemed to be, you know, make the dollar worth a little more. And then the Russians tried that. That seemed like a good move. Where do we think about this? Like, so if the plan is to drain Russia of their resources, men, will, whatever, how long do we have to drain them? How long is this going to go? Because the last time I checked, Russia was a massive country with a history of being the type of people that don't necessarily give up real easily, especially on the battlefield. So what's the time frame for this?
Well, I think it's permanent, right? They're trying to permanently damage the Russian economy. I think if we look back to 2019... There's a RAND Corporation study they put out, which essentially says the U.S. has to weaken Russia. And it lays out, I think it was a 6-point plan. And this was like point 4 or 5 was starting the war in Ukraine. Mm. But it was, you know, foster regime change in Kazakhstan and Belarus and arm the Ukrainian Nazis and really just do everything to push Russia into a war in Ukraine. And ultimately, and this is going to sound kind of confusing at first or conspiratorial, I think this is about China, right? They see that they don't want a multipolar world. And so they think that they could confront China if it's just China. But if it's China and Russia, this is going to be a more problematic issue because China could get a lot of their resources from Russia. And that gives the U.S. a lot less leverage over China. And so I think looking to weaken Russia and to isolate the Russian economy is about being able to make sure the U.S. is the unipolar power, you know, 10, 20 years down the road. And that ultimately isn't, I think, really a threat from Russia as much as it is from Beijing. And so they're, you know, they want to cripple the Russian economy now, so it's not there to help Beijing. And the, you know, there's this massive Shanghai Cooperation Organization, this treaty group, trade group that's now, I think, 15 countries with Turkey becoming the next member. It represents over half the world population. Iran's a member. All these Southeastern Asian and Asian states are members of this now. And so I think they're really concerned and they see Russia as a major key player in all this. And taking Russia down many pegs, they think will hurt China in the years to come. And so I think that's a lot of it. And that's why when you look at what happened after Biden took office in 2021, well, the first thing he did is he extended the New START treaty because the U.S. actually doesn't want to fight a nuclear war against Russia. But then after that, all the steps that Washington took were not to foster diplomacy with Moscow in any way or to try to reset ties in any way. They took steps and in September and November in 2021, they asserted that Ukraine will one day become a NATO state. And as Ted Galen Carpenter wrote, I believe for Cato on September 30th, 2021, Ukraine was a de facto member state. And we've now heard these comments from several members of the Ukrainian government, including the Ukrainian President Zelensky himself, but they, you know, carried out major war games during this time. And Russia was saying, like, let's rein this in. Let's, you know, reset the ties in Eastern Europe, come to some kind of agreement. Look, you know, initially after the fall of the Cold War, NATO wasn't supposed to expand. Germany was supposed to be reunited. And that was supposed to be a NATO member state in Germany, but Poland and all those other states, including, you know, these former states that were a part of the Soviet Republic, not just Warsaw Pact states like the Baltic states, all ended up joining NATO. But, you know, they really wanted to spend expand NATO into Ukraine. And that was the Russian red line as the current CIA director. But then I believe he was ambassador to Russia, William Burns, wrote in a memo to Condoleezza Rice. So it was in 2008, saying that it was the brightest of all red lines, Ukrainian NATO membership. And we now have heard from Biden administration officials that when Russia was putting forward their list of demands in December, they didn't even consider the NATO membership for Ukraine, even though they knew it was the brightest of all Russian red lines. They refused to negotiate over any of this. And so essentially, you know, they just allowed this to build in, you know, this war happened, and I think Washington wanted it.
Wow.
Yeah, this is a real gamble, it seems like, because you want to isolate Russia. I get that. They say, well, you know, Russia and China could team up. Let's pick one of them. Let's pick one off and weaken them and everything. But if you are, you know, unsuccessful, and I would suggest that the Western sanctions have been unsuccessful, in maybe not completely unsuccessful, but they didn't have the benefit that they thought. This is a gamble, because it then forces Russia closer to China to say, hey, you see what these people are doing? You see what these guys are doing to us? They're trying to pick us off and get us, you know, from cooperating with one another. Hey, why don't you, China, why don't you go to Saudi Arabia and get rid of that petrodollar? That's so 1970s. Like, let's make it the petro you want. You buy 2.5 million barrels of oil from the Saudis every day. The Americans don't do that anymore. Why don't you guys do that arrangement? Isn't that what eventually will more than likely happen, is that Russia and China will partner up in advance of this and gather, like you said, that region, that South Asia region. You've got India, who says, we don't have a problem. We'll buy oil from whoever. We're not going to get on board with this sanctions. So now you've got the two most populous countries in the world that are willing to partner up with Russia. And then you take one more and you say, well, maybe we could have the Saudis come in. Is this a misstep by the United States? Have they thought, are they playing a couple steps ahead, or are they just reacting here?
I mean, well, if you look at the U.S. foreign policy over the past three decades, everything's been a misstep and a mistake. And so, you know, I think when I initially started really following U.S. foreign policy, I felt like there has to be something wrong, because they can't get it wrong every single time. And this, you know what I mean? The people who are now the Biden foreign policy team are all the assistants during the Obama administration who have come back in, and now they're heading to departments and things like that. You know, Lloyd Austin was the head of CENTCOM, now is the head of the Department of Defense. Sam Power was a, you know, assistant in the State Department. Now she's running USAID. And so you have all these people who got significant promotions. But if you look at what happened during the Biden, the Obama administration, Libya was a disaster. You know, the surge in Afghanistan was a disaster. The war in Syria is the biggest disaster that's still like unfolding, and there's no way to resolve it. The war in Yemen, the worst thing happening in the world, all these things, you know, originate under the Obama administration. So I guess we really shouldn't be surprised that all these failures, you know, getting promotions are only failing bigger than they did before. And so, yeah, I think, you know, one of our writers at antiwar.com is Ray McGovern, who was a former CIA analyst and who briefed the first President Bush, has been screaming in our pages for a year that, hey, the Biden administration, what Trump did, but, you know, following what the Biden administration did, has pushed Moscow and Beijing together. And you guys in the White House really need to take it seriously when Putin is talking to Xi and they're putting out statements saying that our relationship exceeds an alliance, that, you know, that these two people are very, Putin and Xi are very good friends. They like have birthday parties together, right? Nobody took notice of this in the White House. When Biden went, and I forget if he talked to Putin personally or had a call with Putin in, I believe, June of 21, he was telling Putin, like, you can't trust the Chinese, right? And, like, warning that, like, you know, we know that the Russia-China relationship isn't that close. You know, he's looking at this through, you know, 1980s viewpoint. It doesn't realize what's happened since 1980s. 1990, and particularly accelerated through the Obama and Trump and now Biden administrations, has driven the two Asian superpowers straight together. And now, you know, you look at Moscow and Beijing having very close ties and don't really seem concerned about, you know, those legacy issues, the territorial issues or anything between the two countries. They're much more concerned about making the world a multipolar world. And I think a lot of this is about the way the U.S. has waged economic wars against both countries over the past decade in particular. You know, whenever the U.S. can wreck your economy and really harm your economy, I guess Russia and China are a little bit more resilient, but, you know, the semiconductor exports that the U.S. has undergone has really hurt China. A lot of things the U.S. has done have hurt both of these countries. And while they've been able to weather sanctions and trade policy somewhat better than the Americans and the Europeans, it doesn't mean that these countries haven't suffered as well. I think they really looked at it, and as well as like Venezuela, Iran, North Korea, and all these other countries, they realized that, you know, they could just start trading and negotiate, you know, be their own kind of common pod of countries and just trade within each other, and the Americans really aren't that important. And so, yeah, it seems like a huge own goal and a huge show of how weak America is that, you know, we're meddling right now on Russia's border and we're trying to isolate the Russian economy. And yet it's hurt the Europeans and the Americans far more than it's hurt the Russians. Just yesterday, if you look at the page today on antiwar.com, my colleague Dave DeCamp, who's our news editor, has a fantastic article up about how there's at least some European officials who are furious with the Americans because the Europeans are bearing the brunt of the economic war, while, you know, rich Americans are getting richer off of selling more American gas to Europe because, you know, they've been cut off from the Russian market. But particularly the Americans are manufacturers are just getting so rich off of this. And so while, you know, average Americans, I think, have been hurt by this war from inflation and you know, just American standing in the world, I do think is going down. And as you said, you're eventually going to see more and more bilateral trade between other countries. I don't think it's just going to be China and Saudi Arabia. It's going to be China and Iran, China and Venezuela, Venezuela and Iran. All these countries are going to do more and more business that completely excludes the U.S. dollar. Those they're not going to be shipped in U.S. dollars, priced in U.S. dollars, insured in U.S. dollars. It's all going to be bilateral. And that was by design of the Americans. They just thought it would hurt all these countries a hell of a lot more than it hurt the West. And it hasn't happened. It's completely backfired so far. And so, yeah, this is a massive own goal. It's unbelievable in a way, but if you look at the past 30 years, it's actually absolutely believable.
Yeah, and I guess I shouldn't be so surprised when Biden brought in the JV team and then they ran the same plays that the Obama administration ran and watched it, watched the results mirror them. Because, yeah, you're right, but under Obama, what did we do? Just expand wars while, you know, claiming that the only downside of his presidency was that he one time wore a tan suit, pretending that he wasn't drone striking wedding parties and then hitting the first responders a half hour later, or just decimating Yemen and all of these things. And then now we have the new batch of morons, the Biden flavored Democrats coming in and starting this. I'm curious though, as we move for a great article by Dave, by the way. I think I saw it on Zero Hedge and then got picked up by Zero Hedge, talking about how the Europe was like, hey, America, you guys seem to be getting rich off this war and we're the ones doing the suffering. It's like, I hate to be the bearer of bad news to the Europeans, but it's like, didn't you know this is our MO, this is what we do. We go around and this is exactly what we do. We, like you say, we wreck economies. If you get in our way, we'll do it to you too. We've been using our dollar as a sledgehammer to club into submission anybody that gets on the wrong side of us. But that dollar hegemony is losing its value. We're now doing the one thing that we knew would destroy us, which is, oh, if we screw up that petrodollar arrangement, it's really going to be a hard one for us to swallow. And what do? Go out and force all these countries, force Russia into the arms of China for, like you mentioned, not just China, but dealing with Venezuela and Iran and all of these. We have now made the dollar obsolete in the process, which takes me to my next point, which is What is the value of the dollar in Ukraine? And what have we uncovered here in the last couple of weeks with this whole FTX component? Because that looks like, it looks like the Ukrainian laundromat just got the FTX 3000 installed, where it can wash money at a rate that Marty Bird would be proud of. Like, what do we make of FTX's involvement in Ukraine?
So the best, most evidenced article I've seen on this is by Kate Clarenberg at The Gray Zone, where he details what the role of FTX was. Now, I'm not like an economic or a crypto guy, and so I'm a little out of my element actually talking about how like all the money laundering worked and everything like that. But I would definitely recommend Kate Clarenberg's article. And look, you know, if this happened to any level, there should be obvious investigations into the potential corruption. Even I think, you know, I've seen from a couple right-wing sources basically saying that this funded the entire Democratic campaign. I don't know if that's the case, like how much money went from Ukraine, from the U.S. government to Ukraine, back to U.S. government coffers. But that definitely needs to be investigated. It just goes to the whole problem with Ukraine. This is an article that I wrote back in March, and they haven't done anything about it. You know, CNN reported that the weapons in Ukraine were falling into a black hole. You know, right. they go, you know, they cross the border from Poland, probably into Lviv, or, you know, maybe they make it to Kiev, and where the U.S. now has some inspectors. But once they get to the battlefield, they have no idea where those weapons are going. Janet Yellen just announced a couple days ago that the U.S. is going to give Ukraine $4.5 billion. I think Samantha Power in the USAID are actually going to get to distribute that, and says it's going to come in like $2 billion tranches over the course of the next month. Right, so we're giving them $4.5 billion just for the next month alone in two lump sums. Well, who knows where that money is going? And right. There's no one in Congress or the White House at all interested in this. I think I've seen the sole agency within the United States that has any interest in carrying out investigations at all is the Department of Defense. And it's only because they're worried that Russia is going to get their hands on some of this technology. So they want to know where this is going, just to make sure that like American weapons aren't able to be sold to different China, Russia, Iran, and then they're able to like duplicate those weapons and reverse engineer and manufacture their own versions of them. But that's the only interest anybody has in any kind of audit of this. And really, other than like Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz, and Thomas Massie, and Rand Paul, I haven't heard any members of Congress even like so much as say like, maybe we should look into this. I mean, it was only 8 years ago that Tulsi Gabbard was introducing bills in the Congress that were the Stop Arming Nazis Act because of how many Nazis there are in the Ukrainian military. And now we're not even concerned about making sure, you know, at least in Syria, the Obama administration pretended to care and pretended to try not to give the arms to the Al-Qaeda terrorists. In Ukraine, there's not even a pretense of this is something we have to worry about and something we have to try to curb or stop, because they know that once again, the extremists are the only effective fighting force. Evelyn Farkas admitted as much in January that this is crazy. One of the only good real like Western in-depth reporting, from the mainstream on the whole Nazi issue in Ukraine in the past year was by Nat Geo. They did their Locked Up Abroad series, and because there's a bunch of Ukrainian Nazis, they like expose these people, and they asked Evelyn Farkas about it, who was an Obama administration official. She said they're the most effective fighters. They're happy to use these Nazis, right? Like, you know, all day in the United States, they'll cry about how we got to worry every right winger, Marjorie Taylor Greene's a Nazi, right? But then when there's actual Nazis with Hitler tattoos going around killing people for being ethnically Russian, then, well, they're the most effective fighters, so we're fine with using them.
It's crazy. If you're living in Europe and you're wondering what to get that special man in your life for Christmas this year, consider a shoulder-fired missile from the black web, whatever the Silk Road equivalent is on the dark web in Europe. I mean, I hear I'm only half joking, but that I hear that there's weapons are finding their way up into the Nordic countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. Finland's intelligence department, or I don't know if it's their CIA or FBI equivalent, said that, yeah, the weapons were making it into Finland at this point and being used by criminals. I mean, so in the early days, like in the first week of the war after the Russian invasion, Kiev, they just opened the armories and gave guns to everyone, including C-14, who are, you know, it stands for the 14 words of the white supremacist creed. So, you know, they're extremists, but right. Also all these games. So Russia never got within, you know, a few miles of Kiev. And yet there was fighting on the heavy fighting on the streets of Kiev in the early days of the yes. war. So nobody's gone back and looked at who got those weapons and who the hell was shooting who, which seems to, you know, maybe be something very important, like were innocent people purged or something like that based on ethnic lines, given that these, you know, ethnic lunatics were the ones getting the guns and everything right. like that. So
what are we concerning?
It was very concerning. I remember hearing that early on in like the early weeks of it and people saying, well, it looks like they're just going and settling scores right now, like things that have nothing to do with Russia, but maybe just had something to do with some internal issues that the Ukrainians had. Now they've got the weapons to do it. That seems like a really bad idea. And didn't we do that? It seems like we did that in the hood here in America, where it's like all of a sudden these trains would show up and doors would open up and there'd be guns and it would wind up in the hands of the gangs. And then we'd say mistakes were made, you know, the Rumsfeldian thing, like, well, you know, can't live in the past, you know? So I'm curious about where we go with, where do we go after this pipeline was blown up? We've got multiple people on video explaining that is what will happen if Russia gets on the wrong side of us, that we will blow up the Nord Stream pipeline, and then boom, it blows up, and then everyone goes, it was you guys that talked about doing it, you're the ones that are doing it. And of course America just said, we don't know what happened. Then we get that very weird text message from the UK, from the Liz Truss in the UK, who was only there for a month or so, saying it's done to Blinken. Was there anything to that? Are we putting on our tinfoil hats here, or is there enough already without a sort of weird text message?
Yeah, so I'm unaware of the text message, but I did think it was the Brits. So that would just confirm my bias if it is true. So initially, you know, a lot of people, I feel like that I'm around, my libertarian friends, immediately thought it was Washington. And I was pretty skeptical of that just because how heavy the Biden administration is concerned about climate change. And I do think it may upset their base if the largest methane leak in history occurred because of an action taken by the White House. And because the White House was effectively able to stop that pipeline with their sanctions, they didn't need to blow it up. Now, Liz Truss is a lunatic. And I do think that she would have ordered that pipeline to be blown up. And, you know, do the Brits do things without the Americans' knowledge? Probably not. And so that at least means the White House was willing to go along with it. It is kind of my suspicion on how this all played out. Now, I guess we don't actually know. There's a lot of other people who could be interested in this. You know, I've talked to a lot of people who point the finger at Poland and say that, you know, because they want enduring hostility and tensions between Russia and the West, because, you know, they'll get a lot of military aid, they'll get a lot of new military bases. A lot of money is going to come into Poland because of the war in Ukraine, and making sure that this is cemented, right? That those pipelines are destroyed, it makes it so that a lot of capital has to be spent to rebuild those pipelines in order to restore the economic ties between Russia and Germany. And so, you know, Warsaw is probably interested in making sure that those ties are permanently damaged. Maybe some of these Baltic states are also concerned. You know, I feel like there's a lot of other possibilities. I really don't think it was Russia. You know, don't know, maybe there's some crazy, it's Moscow, the Kremlin, it's a government, right? Our government officials are terrible. Their government officials are equally terrible. Well, probably not equally, but they could also be terrible. And so they could have made a huge miscalculation thinking that this would promote some kind of infighting between the West and the US or something like that and blew up their own pipeline. But it seems really unlikely to me that it was Russia. You got to turn up a lot of evidence, to prove that. It's a pretty, you got to go a couple levels down the conspiracy theory train where I think Liz Truss is probably the villain here.
Yeah, I picked the U.S. as the culprits just because we love stuff like this. And obviously we said we would do it. But in the end, U.S., U.K., what's the difference, really? In the end, there's pipeline explosions. We've got a bridge explosion. We've got a Turkmenistan pipeline explosion. We've got a car blowing up with allegedly Putin's brain in it, but his brain wasn't in it. His brain's daughter was in there. So it's like we've antagonized them quite a bit. We've antagonized the Russians a lot. Are you surprised that they, I mean, would you say that the Russians have shown restraint in this situation, given the sort of like overt attempts to draw them into responding to these obvious attacks against them?
Well, I mean, if you look at it as a matter of like perspective and degree, then yes. Obviously, if you invade another country, like, I'm anti-war. I'm anti-war doctor.
Me too.
That's, so I oppose core, the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Right. Like I see a whole bunch of nuance as to why Russia decided to invade Ukraine. I still think if you look at what's happened to Russia since, I think it's obviously a mistake. Now, maybe Russia miscalculated on how much support they thought the West would give Kiev and that they thought that there was no way that the West would pressure Zelensky out of making the April agreement. But that's what happened. And now Putin is kind of in a real quagmire of essentially his own making since he's the one that decided to invade Ukraine. However, if you look at the steps that Russia has taken, they really didn't start bombing Ukraine's energy grid until after all the events you talked about, the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline, and particularly the bombing of the Kerch Bridge and attacks on other Russian and even civilian facilities like the Kerch Bridge in Crimea, which is pretty well established Russian territory. You know, we in the U.S. could color that map, the Crimean Peninsula, in the color of Ukraine, but ultimately it is Russia and will forever be Russia.
Yeah.
So, and there's nothing we do about that. So Russia sees that as strikes on its own territory. And so in the past 2 or 3 months, they've carried out some brutal attacks on Ukraine's civilian infrastructure. And, I don't want to discount or downplay any of that. However, they've still gone far short of what the U.S. did when we invaded Iraq, right? Like what Russia has done now in 9 months is about probably equivalent to the destruction of the first week or month of the U.S. of the Iraqi infrastructure. And so, again, that isn't to excuse the Russian behavior or anything like that. But, you do have to look at this from the perspective of what America has done, because America is leading the anti-Russia charge here. And, that's why I think the rest of the world, like India, China, I don't think China really supports the war in Ukraine. When Russia made nuclear threats, China denounced it. China and India signed on to the G20 summit that condemned the war in Ukraine, but said some members have other opinions on the matter. But they do see that, this isn't the worst thing that's happened in the world like Washington is pretending. And so, if we're from the American perspective, then yeah, Russia has been restrained, especially given the narrative that we see all the time on our mainstream media, which just, isn't an accurate reflection of really what's happened in the war so far.
Yeah. I mean, I'm with you. I'm anti-war to my core. That's where it starts. I recognize wars happen, but then the media spin on it and all of the confusion, it would have had a little bit more meaning to me if it was, say, I don't know, India
calling out Russia and saying, you really shouldn't be invading this country. This is really bad. When America does it, it's just like, really? You're going to be the one? It's like the guy who cheats on his girlfriend all the time and who's like, bro, you really shouldn't be cheating on your girlfriend. Everyone's just like, what are you talking? You're the last person that should be commenting on this. And with America, it feels like, you know, we're out there talking about how these unprovoked attacks, that's in the mainstream media, it's always unprovoked Russian attacks, unprovoked war, unprovoked. Well, it's not totally unprovoked. I'm still against the war, but to call it unprovoked is kind of laughable. It would have been nice if America wasn't the one sort of, you know, running the, you know, the outrage mob, considering how, you know, what we like to do, which is turn off the lights in a country on day one and knock out their water and knock out their hospitals and knock out their communication and blind them immediately. And then, you know, so I don't know. I didn't see Russia doing any of that until about 8 months into the war. And I thought it, and really only after the West or Ukraine and the West had knocked out some, had targeted some civilian things, like you mentioned, like the bridge. So I'm curious though. So as we get, you know, we transition from this Ukrainian war where America is sort of injected itself into it. Now we see this other war, potential war on the horizon, and I don't really know what to make of it. I'm sure you guys over there have a really good understanding of it. And that's this China-Taiwan component. Now, I do fully recognize that a lot of times there's saber rattling as a pretext to justify a bloated military budget or to create pressure to in order to get some things that you want. There was never really going to be a war, but they talk about it like there's going to be a war. I don't know what to make of this China-Taiwan situation because it seems like China is in a particular spot right now with their own domestic situations. They've got COVID zero problems. They've got a real estate industry that is in collapse. They have a lot of questions in their own state. When we'd have that, we tend to start wars to distract from that. That makes me nervous that China might want to distract from that by starting a war with Taiwan. What do you guys think over there at antiwar.com?
I guess I don't think China's really ready for that invasion yet. It's a big island. It's like 100 miles or so off the coast of China. So, you know, it's going to take a lot to invade Taiwan. Taiwan has a lot more advanced U.S. weapons than Ukraine had at the time of invasion. And I think, Russia moving across the border into territories of Ukraine that where there were already forces fighting that were supportive of Russia is a far less complicated military, you know, maneuver than invading Taiwan across the strait. And so I'm not sure China has the ability to actually invade Taiwan at this point. I think if you look at what China's probably strategy would be if they felt they had to take some kind of action in Taiwan in the next even 5 years, my guess is they would try to blockade the island and prevent trade from coming in and out of the island versus actually trying to put their forces on Taiwan, maybe carrying out some strikes or something like that. But even my guess is they would try to keep it more to an economic blockade. As to your bigger point, I think the Libertarian Party in New Hampshire put out a tweet, I'm pretty sure it was today, where it shows that China is an internal basket case. And they say conservatives, is this, you know, your big nightmare? Is this what you're afraid of? Is this what we have to orient our entire society against, is China, this centrally planned monstrosity where, you know, they struggle to control their own territories. Not that I sign on at all to the Uyghur genocide narrative, but, you know, there's terrorism in Xinjiang, China. There's resistance to Beijing in Xinjiang, China, Tibet, and Taiwan's a whole Chinese province in exile. Hong Kong, has, I guess, more of a limited amount of autonomy. But at the same time, you know, just looking at China and what they're even able to do in historic China isn't a threat in any way at all to the United States of America. And so for all of us to be freaking out about China all the time is just, you know, so overstated. Yeah, I don't think an invasion of Taiwan is coming anytime soon. And in a lot of ways, with the situation in Ukraine, I think we're playing out something very similar in Taiwan, where China doesn't care, or at least hasn't cared, and is fine with a long-term policy of reunification with Taiwan. They don't want to have to militarily take over Taiwan or anything like that. That, you know, they plan 50 years out, and maybe then there would be reunification with the island. However, if America essentially declares Taiwan independence and starts giving them all NATO weapons and makes them a major non-NATO ally, well, then, like the situation in Ukraine, you're going to provoke China to act very aggressively against Taiwan. And again, I think that in the near term, that would come in the form of the economic blockade. But you know, in the long term, you know, who knows? Maybe they would try an invasion if the U.S. is considering stationing like strategic weapons or something on Taiwan. You know, maybe that would provoke China.
Yeah, I wonder why we would want that. I know we all, when I say we, I mean our American foreign policy, but why we just want to destabilize everybody, keep everybody fighting or something like that? Because I'll tell you, if my enemy, who's holding $1.5 trillion of my debt and provides me 97% of my pharmaceuticals that I need, I don't know that I'd be really in a hurry to create problems with that person. But here we are, and America is doing this again. We're starting to mess with China. You mentioned a blockade of Taiwan. Couldn't we just see a blockade of the United States by China as well? Just them saying, you know, we just really aren't going to be sending any more ships to you guys. And get us to sort of calm down in a sense from a trading standpoint. Is that a possibility, or would that just be, or is China too strategic to do something like that?
I think at this point, you know, China and the U.S. are still too reliant on each other to pull something like that. I think it would damage either economy too much. You know, you could have tariffs and cut trade here and there and put restrictions on trade and things like that. But to actually go full decoupling, or, you know, even in a temporary sense, probably be too much of a blow to either economy. You know, it backfire for Washington or Beijing right now. Although, you know, we have a lot of people in the U.S., and I'm sure there's people in China as well that are very serious about decoupling. And so, you know, if Beijing is worried about being cut off by the U.S., maybe they put themselves in a position. You know, we saw this from Russia, that, you know, after 2014, all they were doing with their economy was preparing to be cut off from the West. And that's why when they were cut off from the West, it wasn't a major blow to the Russian economy. The ruble actually was doing better against the dollar this summer than it had done in several years. And that was because, again, Russia was prepared for this. So I'm sure China is preparing to some degree. And we have particularly conservatives in the West really pushing decoupling from China. And so maybe, you know, if we're looking 5 years down the line, that is something that could happen either way, because we scaled back our economic relationships enough that it wouldn't do that much internal damage. But, you know, on the why, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, military spending. When you look at the war in Ukraine, there's a lot of problems. Ukraine, if you go back and read any publication before 2021 about Ukraine, they're the most corrupt country in Europe. That's a huge problem. Again, if you look before 2021, the army is infested with neo-Nazis. Right. Their president is a comedian, right? It's a fairly split and unstable country. You know what I mean? Like, the people of Crimea actually voted to leave. The people of the Donbass wanted to vote to leave. I don't know about the referendums that happened during the war, but there was a referendum held in 2015. The people of the Donbass all would have voted to join Russia. And so that's far more complicated, where with Taiwan, I think you are looking at more of an economic powerhouse than economic liability. I'm sure there are unsavory people in Taiwan, just like everywhere else, but their National Guard isn't made up of the Azov Battalion. Right? Like, these are advantages that you have. Also, I think from particularly the perspective of American conservatives, they're not really interested in the Cold War redux in Ukraine. And they don't view Russia as, you know what I mean? If I remember the maps of the Soviet Union. I was born in 1990, but when I went to like elementary school and everything, Russia was still the Soviet Union, which consumed, you know, the entire top half of Asia and a huge chunk of Europe. And now it's just Russia, which is still big, but is far, you know, less substantial, has a far smaller population, is far less militarily powerful, where China is on the rise, you know, and they do have 1.3 billion people and their economy is large and all those fads too. Conservatives sound very, very scary. And so I think it's easier to get the, you know, vast majority of Americans on board with defending Taiwan versus Ukraine, which again, doesn't have all those problems. Also, you know, naval, there's just a lot more room for like naval activity with when it comes to China versus the war in Ukraine. You got the Black Sea, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just, I think there's a lot more spending that could happen. Look, the army is developing missiles specifically for China. There, all this is just huge amounts of money that's being poured in. There's a Pacific Defense Initiative, which is just a massive pot of money that Congress gave to the Pentagon. They said, here, spend this on the war with China. So that's a lot of it.
That's a problem too, because when you financially incentivize these people, these military industrial complex groups, to be worried about a potential war because they're going to get more money, then isn't it funny? They'll always be worried about a potential war breaking out. I'm curious though, what's going on in, well, let's stay on this for a second. Biden's administration, and I know this happens probably for every administration, but goddamn, he's got a bunch of people in his upper management that have just recycled out over the last 2 years or so out of the Trilateral Commission. And I get very nervous when I see these guys because I know what they're up to. Blinken and National Security, Jake Sullivan and these people. These are all trilaterals that want open borders, one world government, and all that stuff. Are we seeing any sort of trilateral fingerprints on these moves that the Biden administration is making?
No, I feel like the Biden administration is probably the most disjointed White House that we've had. Maybe you got to go back to Bush, but I feel like you have a lot of people who are just working on their own things, and that the foreign policy as a whole doesn't make sense. If you want to isolate Russia on the world stage, the number one things to do would have been to lift the sanctions on Venezuela and to re-enter the Iran nuclear agreement. Two things that Biden very could have easily have done. He ran on being the opposite of Donald Trump. All he had to do was be the opposite of Donald Trump, and he could have reversed those policies, put a lot more oil back on the market, made it so that the Europeans were far more able to withstand scaling back on Russian energy imports. And then it wouldn't have benefited India and China so much, being able to buy Russian oil and then resell it to Europe or something like, you know what I mean? Like just the whole way this has played out has been nonsensical. The Biden administration, rather than just keeping their mouths shut on the Korean issue, signed a trilateral agreement with Japan and South Korea during the NATO summit in Madrid. In June, they signed an agreement, and that set off Kim Jong-un in North Korea, and he, you know, has scaled up his missile tests and has conducted a record number this year. And so now the U.S., you know, is dealing with Iran, where we're saying we're not even trying to negotiate with them anymore. The new Iran policy is to help the regime change operation. We've stayed involved in Yemen and Syria. I mean, Libya still, like, none of these things have been resolved. And it's like the U.S. is, you know, essentially trying to maintain its global hegemony and hold on and, you know, maintain our power over China, over Russia, isolate completely Venezuela, Nicaragua, Iran, North Korea. And it's just not working at all. And so, you know what I mean? You could imagine that if they really did want to shift to the great power competition, then they would have had to, like, you know, settle up with Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Iran, and at least not make Kim Jong-un mad. And they've done the exact opposite of that. And so you almost have to assume that, you know, you just have all these people conducting all their other little actions, which is, I'm guessing, why even in the midst of the war in Ukraine, The U.S. is doing everything it can to recruit the Canadians to go send peacekeepers to Haiti to conduct a regime change operation there. I mean, the only good thing about the war in Ukraine I could imagine is I'm pretty sure that's the only thing that kept the Americans out of Ethiopia and Haiti so far.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy. Well, I just speaking of Venezuela, I just saw that the courts gave Chevron permission to start drilling again in Venezuela.
But they can't do any business with the Venezuelan government.
They can't.
So I think it's going to be pretty limited. And, you know, maybe this is a good first step towards having some kind of normal relation with Venezuela. Unfortunately, now that we're 2 years into the Biden administration, these things take time. Biden needed to start moving on Venezuela day one. That way, by now, we have almost a normal relationship. And 2 years from now, companies are well profiting off of the relationship with Venezuela. That way, when we have like the lunatic Ron DeSantis take office in 2024, he can't just immediately undo all of this, right? Like that there are some legacy interests and Americans are benefiting off of the relationship, but Biden's going to drag his feet to the point where he does almost nothing his whole first term in office. And then when a Republican takes over, they're just going to reverse it and probably run on it. Particularly DeSantis is going to run on it because of the Venezuelan exile community in Florida and everything.
Yeah. You mentioned Haiti. God, those poor people. One of the preachers, I had it in my first book. The quote is talked about how Haiti did a bad deal with the devil. And then he goes, true story. And I put in there, like, just because you say, it was like Jimmy Swaggart or one of those guys. And it's like, just because you say it's a true story doesn't mean it's a true story. Anyway, Haiti has been through the ringer. And then we had this weird situation a couple years ago where the prime minister, somebody was murdered.
Through all this for you. So I think it was July 7th, 2021, Jovenel Moïse, who was the president of Haiti at the time, was assassinated in his home. His wife was also shot, but played dead and miraculously survived. There was a lot of reports of American involvement because the assassins apparently showed up at the door and claimed to be with the DEA. At the time, apparently Moïse, and this I believe is pretty confirmed at this time, was working on a major dossier that he was planning on turning over to the DEA that was supposed to help round up a lot of the drug traffickers and gangs in Haiti. And a lot of people think this was the catalyst for his murder. At the time, Claude Joseph was the prime minister, but Moïse apparently had planned to appoint Ariel Henry as the prime minister. And in Haiti, I guess if the president's assassinated, the prime minister tends up. I don't think the prime minister has a lot of power other than kind of being the vice president, right? Mm-hmm. And so Moïse was apparently planning on appointing Henry, but you know, Claude Joseph ends up taking over because he's the prime minister at the time. Western powers pushed by the United States force Claude Joseph out of power, and Ariel Henry takes over. The New York Times has done a couple investigative reports that point the finger pretty strongly at Ariel Henry at least having a major role in the assassination, if not being the main player behind it. And there are Haitians, including a judge and a prosecutor, who believe that Ariel Henry was the man behind the assassination. Either way, that he's been the most ineffective ruler that you could imagine. The country's completely devolved into chaos. The capital, Port-au-Prince, is run by gangs. Journalists are regularly killed on the street there. Last, I want to say it was like November or something, there was a charity that had donated a new generator. You know, these are big, not like, you know, one that you have in your backyard that you start with the mower pull string, but like a big generator that comes on back of a truck in a shipping container was being moved into a children's hospital in Haiti, and gangs stole that. You know, these are the kinds of, you know, corruption and theft that we're talking about. It's not, you know, that the gangs there go around and car, you know, jack cars. They steal everything. Like the entire state is being robbed. And so rampant poverty, rampant violence in Haiti right now. And the United States is really trying to push a UN resolution to deploy peacekeepers there, which last time peacekeepers were there, they polluted all of Haiti's drinking water and caused a major cholera outbreak that killed 10,000 people and didn't do a damn thing to help anyone.
Yeah, that's what we tend to do when we go into these peacekeeping operations. If the UN goes in, then you can just add a string of rapes in the aftermath of that as well. This is disgusting. Poor Haiti. You know, they've been, you know, if they're the earthquakes and then the Clintons get involved and loot the place. Didn't the Clintons spend their honeymoon in Haiti? That's weird. Are we still stealing Syria's oil?
Yeah. So there's still a lot of that going on. I forget the name of the company. Fortunately, the oil isn't very well developed there, and ISIS was control of it at one point. So I think they looted a lot of the technology and tried to, you know, I mean, as they were leaving these areas, they were just selling and destroying everything they could. So I don't think they're able to get a lot of oil, and what they are, they put on the back of trucks and they, I think, send it over to Iraq and do, I don't know what with it then. But we're still selling that oil. And just on the Haiti and the rape thing, another thing that's a huge issue with the UN, there is just a big article on this coming out of the Congo. And it's such an important issue. And Eliza Blue, who's a great advocate for, you know, victims of human trafficking and everything, has, you know, explained, and we've talked about this a little bit too. But basically what happens is you have these peacekeepers, they're, you know, 18 to 20 something year old men. They get deployed to these countries and they tell often underage girls that, like, hey, you know, I'll marry you and everything like that. That these women are in absolute poverty. These are people that carry guns and are authorities in their country. And so they agree. And then the peacekeepers' rotations grow. And so after, you know, they've, you know, have a couple kids with this woman, or, you know, just have sex with her a bunch of times with, you know, don't care if they had kids or not, they leave. There's never been a case of a UN peacekeeper having to pay child support. And so, you know, these women are just left with babies with absolutely no financial help whatsoever. And it's just like, it's rampant, and the UN doesn't care and they don't do anything about it. And it'll happen again in Haiti if the UN peacekeepers are deployed back there.
Yeah, it will. It happened in Serbia, Bosnia, but back then. I have a friend who did a tour there, and it's just in the aftermath of all of this, you know, it's so chaotic. And obviously we talked about Ukraine, human trafficking there. Haiti, no different, human trafficking operations set up. It's weird that always in the aftermath of U.S.'s adventurous foreign policy, we wind up leaving the worst people behind to manage and the mop-up duty, and then they wind up with a string of rapes and whatnot. It's a dangerous time to be alive. It's I'm really grateful you guys are over there making sense of all this insanity. We know that we're moving into a period now where we're going to start to see resource wars for things that are used to, fuel the electric vehicle boom, things like that. You know, I'm worried about the Democratic Republic of Congo for having so much cobalt. Not their problem, but it's going to be their problem. And we understand how these resource wars go. I think that what you guys are doing over at antiwar.com is fantastic. It's probably the best resource for this. Where can people find you, support your work, and make sure that they're following what you're working on?
Yeah. So as you know, we mentioned several times, I'm at antiwar.com. I'm the opinion editor. And if there's an important thing to do is to read the front page of antiwar.com every day. I'm also the news editor at the Libertarian Institute. Pretty much everything I do at the Institute does end up at antiwar.com. Right now at the Institute, we're holding our winter fund drive. So if you got an extra couple bucks, we really appreciate it if you head on over and support. And then I'm also the host of Conflicts of Interest. I do a show three times a week. Once a week, my co-host Connor Freeman's on with me. Usually he's talking Iran and China, keeping up to date on that. but just always talking about the wars. The past year's coverage has been so dedicated to Ukraine. In the past, I really prided myself on like taking time to talk about the African wars and things like that. It's just kind of falling off the radar with talking about nuclear war, but I do hope to get back to that a little bit more soon. But I do try to keep up with all of America's interventions and at least, you know, mention and keep up what's happening in Haiti, Syria, Yemen, Afghanistan, even after the U.S. exit, you know, particularly right now, northern in the Sahel regions of Africa where there's a lot of conflict going on. So I cover a lot on the show. And yeah, if you're interested in foreign policy at all, check it out.
Please do. And if you're, listen, if you've got more money than you've got time, consider donating some of your money to antiwar.com. If you've got more time than you've got money, well, then donate some of your time and effort and spread their word, share it, get it out there. We appreciate the amazing support that you guys are, or the amazing work that you guys are doing. And we hope that the listeners will go over there and support it as well. That's Kyle Anzalone, everybody. He is the assistant editor over at antiwar.com. If you like this episode, you can take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can follow me on Twitter at macroaggression. Thanks, everybody.